You're listening to On the Ward podcast. Stay tuned.
Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of the On the Ward podcast, and I'm your host, Reginald. So in today's episode, we're going to be discussing appendicitis, and today's guest needs no introduction. Sherif, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me once again, Reginald.
Okay. So how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
So after the Sunday loss to Chelsea, are you sure you're fine?
Oh yeah, I'm very good. It's all part of the
master plan.
I mean, I told you, if every day you're playing with kids, right? If you win every time, eventually they lose. I mean, they don't want to play with you again. So sometimes you have to let them win like once or twice so that they still have hope
that
they can, you know, just might be able to beat you the next time. Then when you get them,
you score them again.
Score them.
Of course. Chelsea is not a meet.
No, they're not.
Very, very minded. All right. So you're going to be talking about appendicitis. Sherif, can we begin?
Okay. So the appendix is an organ in the gastrointestinal tract, right? And if you remember from the first episode we recorded about acute intestinal obstruction, we divided the gastrointestinal tract into basically three portions, right? Yeah. If you haven't listened to the episode, you should go back and listen to that. Because this will make much more sense if you already listened to that episode first.
Yeah.
So basically, the GIT is divided into three portions. Well, we divided it into three portions, right? The first portion being the esophagus, the second part being the stomach, and the third part being the intestine. In the intestine, you can divide that further into two portions, right? Well, three, the small intestine, the large intestine, and then the rectum. So as part of the large intestine, there's a small worm-like projection called the appendix. Its function is not really known yet, but then it causes a lot of problems when it gets bad. And usually the appendix is attached, is retrocecal, right? Meaning it's behind the cecum. But then in different individuals, it can be at different positions. It can be subhepatic when there's a mild descent during its formation. Then it can be paraileal, just at any point around the ileum. It can also be pelvic, in the pelvic cavity. And then in cases of situs inversus, it can be all the way on the left side. This is important because the clinical features, though the specific features will remain the same, the positions where you would be able to elicit the features might change depending on the positions of the appendix. So keep that in mind for later.
Okay, so we are saying that the appendix is mostly retrocecal, but in some cases, you can find it in the pelvis, can be paraileal, and sometimes can be subhepatic due to mild descent of the bowel. Or when the situs inversus, you can find it in the left iliac fossa. So situs inversus is basically a congenital condition where the major visceral organs are reversed or mirrored. So if the visceral organ is normally supposed to be at the left side, you find it at the right side rather. So in this case, the appendix is in the left iliac fossa instead of the right iliac fossa where it's normally found.
Exactly. So yeah, so appendicitis is basically inflammation of the appendix. And this condition is usually not common with individuals at the extremes of life. So you wouldn't find it in the aged and in infants. But like those in the middle, you can have appendicitis occurring at different rates.
Usually common in the middle age.
And the young adults.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay, so some of the causes of appendicitis include an impacted fecolith, which is basically feces that is hardened, fibrous adhesions, strictures, obstructions by certain parasites like schistosoma and then oxyuria.
So studies has also shown that the change in diet from highly cellulose diet and high fiber diets to cellulose depleted diets have also led to the rise in cases of appendicitis due to the formation of tenacious and firm feces from these cellulose depleted diets and a longer transit time, which may lead to the obstruction of the appendix and cause inflammation of the appendix. So dietary sophistication has also led to the increase of appendicitis.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, I think it will even make more sense when we talk about the pathophysiology. So let's get right into that.
Okay.
The way I like to think about the pathophysiology of appendicitis, right?
Yeah.
I like to think about it occurring in two steps. there's an initial simple, I like to call it a simple catarrhal like inflammation, catarrhs in like catar code.
So viral?
Not viral per se, it's just a mild inflammation per se. So okay. What happens is that there's a mild inflammation of the appendix, right? And then this inflammation, usually it resolves spontaneously.
Okay.
And then, but then when it resolves, because of the inflammation, there'll be residual like fibrosis and structure formation, which would predispose the appendix to obstruction.
Okay.
Then now, things that initially wouldn't obstruct the appendix will get obstructed in the appendix.
Okay.
Then that leads to the whole cascade of inflammation upon inflammation, causing what we know as clinically as appendicitis. So yeah, so that's how I like to think about the pathophysiology. Two simple steps. There's a simple catarrhal inflammation, which can be caused by anything. It can be an E. coli infection, but anything that causes bacteria, a mild infection, any bacterial, any infection. Yeah, and that's how schistosoma eggs and the other parasites come into it. Because they elicit an inflammatory response, which would then cause fibrosis or strictures in the appendix or adhesions per se. And then that would predispose the appendix to an obstruction. And we are all aware of the principle in medicine where we see wherever there's an obstruction, there's usually an infection behind the obstruction. So how this happens is that you have your catarrh inflammation that predisposes the appendix to an obstruction. Then an obstruction comes inside. Then with the obstruction, what happens is that now the appendix on its own is usually secretes mucus. Now there's an obstruction, so the appendix cannot be drained. Then the mucus starts to aggregate inside the appendix, then causing distension. What this distension does is, first of all, it puts pressure on the walls of the appendix. This compromises the venous drainage of the appendix, leading to congestion, which would eventually lead to accumulation of deoxygenated blood and then waste products. And then eventually you have the walls of the appendix undergoing gangrene, which can also cause perforation. When this happens, you can see how the perforation, the gangrene, will cause an inflammatory response from the immune system, leading to appendicitis.
All right, so can you do a quick summary on how the pathophysiology is?
Okay, so what happens is that you have step one, there's a simple catarrhal inflammation that can be caused by anything. When that happens, the patient will usually feel like pain, which resolves spontaneously. But that catarrhal inflammation predisposes the individual to obstruction because the inflammation will resolve with fibrosis and stricturing. And now this gives the opportunity for fecalith and other hard substances to get obstructed in the appendix. Once they get in, they can't come out because the lumen is now narrowed. Then an infection develops behind the obstruction. Then that infection can lead to peritonitis. On the other hand, you can also have the continuous secretion of mucus by the appendix causing distension of the appendix. Now this distension puts pressure on the
walls
of the appendix, compromising the venous drainage of the appendix, and it can lead to gangrene, perforation, will lead to like a more severe form of appendicitis.
So when there's a perforation, it leads to peritonitis, where the peritoneum
membrane will be involved.
Exactly.
While this is going on, the body will try to control the inflammation, and then it does this in two ways, either by forming an appendiceal mass or an appendiceal abscess. So an appendiceal mass is formed when the perforated, inflamed, or gangrenous appendix is surrounded by the edematous cecum, the omentum, and the terminal ileum, forming a mass in the right iliac fossa to sort of prevent the infection from spreading. Then on the other hand, it can form an appendiceal abscess. This is where the inflamed appendix is surrounded by its accumulating pus and walled off from the abdominal cavity by an abscess capsule. So then you would have the formation of an appendix abscess. Of course, this can rupture on its own and then lead to the severe appendicitis we are talking about. But more often than not, it will lead to controlling the infection.
So let's talk about the clinical features of appendicitis.
Okay, so as usual, I'll divide them into symptoms and signs. So on the word, The first symptom the patients will complain of is pain. The pain usually starts centrally around the umbilicus, and after a while it will migrate. Depending on the position of the appendix in the individual, the pain might migrate to the right iliac fossa if the appendix is retrocecal, which that's the case in most individuals. If the appendix is subhepatic, the pain will migrate to the right hypochondrium, and in that place it can be taken for acute cholecystitis.
Okay.
If it's situs invertus, the pain will migrate to the left iliac fossa. And then if it's a pelvic appendix, the pain will be felt in the suprapubic region. And you might get additional symptoms from there due to irritation of the bladder, causing urinary symptoms. The second group of symptoms you'd expect the patient to report are nausea, vomiting, and anorexia. And then thirdly, you'd expect there to be altered bowel habits. And this is because, the appendix is part of the colon. If there's inflammation, there'll be colonic irritation, which will obviously affects the function of the bowel. This usually manifests as constipation, but in a few number of cases, it might come as diarrhea, which can be quite confusing when you're making a diagnosis. Okay. And when you perform an abdominal examination on these patients, the first sign you'll be likely to pick up is, depending on the position of the appendix, there'll be tenderness, rebound tenderness, and guarding in the right iliac fossa if it's the retrocecal appendix. If it's subhepatic, these signs would be in the right hypochondrium. If it's pelvic, they'll be around the suprapubic area. And if it's situs inversus, these will be present in the left iliac fossa.
Okay, so there are a few signs that you can also elicit. The first one is the SWAS sign. So with the SWAS sign, what you do is that when you extend the hip joint, there's irritation of the SWAS muscle. So the patient feels pain around the right iliac fossa, due to irritation of the psoas muscle by the appendix, the inflamed appendix. Also, you can also perform an obturator sign where the hip joint is internally rotated and externally rotated, and the patient also feels pain around that area, which is the right iliac fossa, due to the inflamed appendix irritating the obturator internus muscle. So the last sign you can elicit is the Rofsing sign, where you deeply palpate the left iliac fossa and the patient feels pain in the right iliac fossa. So let's talk about some differentials of acute appendicitis.
Okay, a few differentials are typhoid perforation, you can have a perforated peptic ulcer, and acute cholecystitis. An important differential is in women of childbearing age, a ruptured ectopic pregnancy could also present similar symptoms and signs. And this condition is a medical emergency, so you have to keep that in mind when taking histories from women who look like they're in childbearing age. With regards to investigations, as usual, we can group them into diagnostic investigations and supporting investigations. The most important investigation for appendicitis is the abdominal ultrasound. And this is because it complements the clinical diagnosis and helps to rule out certain differentials, especially in women with gynecological conditions. Another investigation you can do is the plain X-ray. On the X-ray, you will see the impacted fecolith around the right iliac fossa. Other investigations are the CT scan and with laparoscopy. With laparoscopy, you can easily visualize the inflamed appendix by tracing the tenia coli of the colon to their point of convergence, where you would find the base of the appendix. There, you can just examine the appendix to find if there's any inflammation going on and diagnose acute appendicitis.
Then you have the supportive investigations. So for the supportive investigation, you can do a full blood count. And usually what you find on the full blood count is an elevated ESR, which is the erythrocyte sedimentation rate, increased C-reactive proteins, and leukocytosis. In addition to that, you can do other routine blood tests, which is your blood, urea, and electrolytes. You can also do a stool test. For instance, in the cases where the appendicitis is caused by the ova of schistosoma, you can find some of the ova in the stool. So finally, we're going to talk about the treatment for appendicitis. All right.
Okay, so with treating appendicitis, usually the mainstay treatment is immediate appendicectomy. However, if an appendix mass or abscess has been formed, you usually adopt a more conservative approach. For the appendiceal abscess, you start with incision and drainage, and then you'd continue with supportive treatments like fluid electrolytes, analgesics, antibiotics, etc. Then you can perform an interval appendicectomy. Also, with an appendiceal mass, you'd prefer not to perform an appendicectomy because the procedure can cause damage to the other components of the appendiceal mass, namely the cecum, the terminal ileum, or even cause a fistula to form involving either of those organs.
So in emergency situations, the Alvarado score is used to determine if a patient needs an immediate appendicectomy or a more conservative approach should be used. So the Alvarado score, if the patient gets a score of more than 4 on the Alvarado score, then you do an immediate appendicectomy. So the Alvarado score consists of 8 components, and there's an easy mnemonic to try and memorize that, which is MANTRELS, MANTRELS. So M stands for migratory abdominal pain, A stands for anorexia, N stands for nausea, and T for tenderness in the right iliac fossa, R for rebound tenderness, E for elevated temperature or fever, L for leukocytosis, and S for shift of neutrophils to the left. So all the components have a score of 1, except for tenderness in the right iliac fossa and leukocytosis, which have a score of 2. So when you add all the scores and you have a score of 4 and above, then you have to perform an immediate appendicectomy. But if it's below 4, you take a more conservative approach. All right, so that brings us to the end of today's episode. I want to say a very big thank you to Sherif for helping us in this discussion.
Thank you for having me. Feeling good.